Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today we talk about the adolescent brain and the coronavirus pandemic. We discuss how teens view the COVID threat and how they cope with physical distancing and mask recommendations. With us, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also psychiatrist Mark Worley. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mindy.
And also joining us is Francis Jensen, professor of neurology and chairman of the neurology at the Perelman School of Medicine, University of Pennsylvania. She's also the author of The Teenage Brain, a neuroscientist's survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults. Welcome.
Good morning.
So I can see some parents' ears perking up saying, wait, what? Somebody understands the teenage brain? But kidding aside, part of our problem as adults may be that we think of them kind of as mini adults, and in fact their brains are developing, which is your whole point, Dr. Jensen, right? So tell us a little bit about that. They're not mini adults.
That's right. I always say they're not adults with fewer miles on them. They may look like adults, they may wear adult clothes sometimes, but they are not. Their brain is not fully developed. The brain is the most complex organ in our bodies, and it takes the longest to mature, not until the mid to late 20s actually. And what we have to realize is that they're going through a period of brain construction, if you will. And some of the most important parts, the executive parts of our brain, not the basic function, but the executive associative part of our brain, are being built in the teen years and early adulthood years. So what we see of behavior, risk-taking, poor judgment sometimes, impulsivity, high levels of emotional states, but also this capacity to learn. Actually, neurobiology can explain these things. And I'll just say very briefly, two big things that can set the stage for some of our discussions is, number one, the teenage brain is a learning machine. The ability to learn and create new connections for learning is still at its peak coming out of childhood. As you know, children can learn 2 and 3 languages, flawlessly. Teenagers are excellent learners too. So they've got very, very active brains. And they have this capacity to learn very quickly. The other part though is that we have specialized parts of our brain, and they are connected by long tracks that go side to side, back and forth, and down our spinal cord and whatever. And that process of building connections between specialized brain regions is what is taking the time, and it moves from the back of the brain to the front of the brain. And just as a newsflash is that the front of the brain contains your frontal lobe, which is where it's a seat of executive function, impulse control, organizational skills, empathy, all those good executive adult traits. And that is what is not yet in place. Meanwhile, the very social part of your brain, the emotional part of your brain called the limbic system, is sort of behind where your ears are. And that is very well connected. So we see that teenagers are kind of running with a social brain without the brakes of the frontal lobe going, bad idea, don't do that. Sometimes we call them, it's like a Ferrari with weak brakes, a teenage brain.
Go ahead, Mark. You wanted to say something?
No, I just want to repeat that because that analogy occurred to me. It's like a car with an excellent gas supply, gas pedal, but no ability to brake it, to slow it down, to stop when there's a barrier in front.
Yeah. So we're seeing some teens and adolescents engage in behaviors that are known to spread the coronavirus, not being physically distanced from one another, not wearing a mask. We've heard about, different parties. And I think we had that here in Falmouth where the principal delayed school and was very disappointed in the decision of some of these teenagers to do that. And I say some because there are some teenagers who are following the rules and others who are not. So research shows that they're as smart, right, as adults. They have ability to reason. So what do you think prompts this risky behavior? I guess it goes back to that impulsivity and not having that frontal lobe developed.
Yeah, so they obviously, teenagers can be brilliant. They can do extremely well on tests, etc. But it's that spur-of-the-moment decision-making that requires these connections to be super fast speed. And the super fast speed of having different parts of your brain connected is a function of insulating literally kind of the wires that connect part A of the brain to part B of the brain, for instance. And that process, just like actually our brain cells talk to each other through electrical signals, and actually, like the electrical wires in our houses, they have to be insulated. There's a fatty substance called myelin that is our insulation, but it has to be built over. We have miles of connections in our brains, literally. And so this process takes 3 decades to finish, and it goes from the back of the brain to the front of the brain. So it's not like they don't actually have connections. They're just not high speed. So you see them being able to work really well in deliberate, you know, situations like tests where they're good guardrails around things. But when they're out in, you know, in the field, if you will, making decisions, they can't make those split-second decisions that they will be able to make as adults as easily as us. But they can learn, and that's going to be part of our discussion, I think.
Yeah, are you talking about they're weak on focusing their attention? Is that part of what you're saying here?
Part of it is saying that the frontal lobe is a decision-maker and also impulse control system, right? So they could be goaded by friends to go and do something outrageous that we would consider outrageous. They consider it very tempting and interesting. And our brains would say, there's too much of a risk here. I could get arrested. I could kill myself, da-da-da. They may not have that signal coming that quickly from their frontal lobe. And also, just remember, they have had less experience with life. So they're going to have less memories stored about which things to connect to, you know, which risks. So both of those things kind of conflate to create kind of a perfect storm in that they're novelty seekers. They're trying to learn, experiment with life. But at the same time, they don't have that their risk aversion is not where it will be later.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think in your book, you also pointed out that the teenage brain is overactive. I mean, in other words, it's always stimulated and stimulating, which is different than what happens older. And I got the impression it was even different than what happened earlier. There's a heightened stimulation, in other words.
Yeah. And through childhood, so there's something called synaptic plasticity. Plasticity meaning that your brain is molded, and synapses, so brain cells are called neurons, and they talk to each other over connections called synapses. And the fact we have this term called synaptic plasticity, which means that you grow the synapses you use a lot, and you kind of extinguish the synapses, like use it or lose it, the synapses that aren't used much. So that's why we see through childhood people develop these prodigious, you know, kind of skill sets, because they can just build synapses so quickly in very specialized ways. And then maybe not in other ways when they are not exposed to something through that section of life. Now, in the teenage years, it's not the basic kind of motor and sensory and language skills that are being built. It's these associative functions, the more evolved, higher order part of the brain is being really constructed in the teenage years. So we see them having the ability to, learn very quickly. And part of that is that they have to experiment. So all animals learn by experimentation. So we believe that that novelty seeking is kind of built in, that the fact they don't have breaks would lead them to more experiences, but we know how Darwinism works out, right? So we, you know, would rather not have that to happen to humans, but there is going to be this, if too many errors are made, that person is not going to be part of the population anymore, right? So that's why we, I think in our culture, we want to manage these risks and not have them come to a very, you know, bad end. There is a natural proclivity of teenagers to explore, and the novelty seeking piece is that, to acquire more memories, to build, if you will.
Sure. Yeah.
Jonathan, you were going to say something.
Yeah, well, I have a question about how mood and the development of the prefrontal cortex also bears on this. So the prefrontal cortex being pretty close to the front of your head, and this isn't something I know anything about, so hopefully, Dr. Jensen, you can shed some light on this. I'm wondering if myelin sheaths also are building in the prefrontal cortex in adolescence. And, you know, anybody who's been a parent or a child psychiatrist is painfully aware of how moody adolescents can be. And I'm wondering how is the moodiness of adolescence to some degree correlate with the incomplete development of the myelin sheaths, even in the prefrontal cortex and deeper structures, and sort of almost adds fuel to the fire of impulsivity and poor judgment.
Yeah, those are. That's a great point to make. So there is science. I can tell you a little bit that we know. So your emotional parts of your brain, say your fear emanates from, say, something called the amygdala. There are emotional parts of the brain in what we call the limbic system that regulate emotionality. And those are very quite well connected. They're sort of behind your ears, if you will. So they're very well connected. And it's also kind of the social brain is in there. That is very well connected in your teen years. And that's why they place a very high emphasis on immediate gratification, social contact, social gratification. Peer pressure has its greatest effect in the teenage brain. And when we do, because the frontal lobes are not dampening down the signal, if you will. So we can do something called magnetic resonance imaging, MRIs. People have probably heard of those. That's how we scan brains. There's something called a functional MRI, where we can show things on a screen to somebody while they're in the MRI and see different parts of their brain light up. And it's actually measuring blood flow to show which parts of the brain are more active. And what's been shown is that when you show a teenager versus an adult a very socially, emotionally charged visual picture or a concerning image, their brains will literally light up twice as high on than an adult brain, because the adult brain will have this suppressing, you know, it's never going to go too far. So there's this sort of, they are twice as active. So they're literally experiencing, I always say, emotion in technicolor compared to our black and white. And this explains why they are so labile, why they go to great highs and great lows. Like their brains, when they may have an argument with somebody at school and they come home and parents might want to say, you know, that's ridiculous, don't be so excited. Well, actually, their brain is functioning like yours would when you hear about an international incident. And so it's wrong to say and belittle their level of, you know, outrage over something. You have to help them through it using your frontal lobe to tell them why it's not such a big deal. And that's where I say parents should have a frontal lobe assist from time to time, you know, for their kids and we around them, because we can sort of explain them back down. Now, that's another really important thing I want to mention about psychiatry and mental illness and mood and teenage years. We need to all remember that about 75% of mental illness, affective disorders, meaning bipolar, schizophrenia, psychosis, depression, come on in the window between 16 and 26 years of age. That's amazing when you think one in five, as you both are psychiatrists, know one in five people, if not more, in our society have some form of, you know, mental psychiatric condition, right? It's so prevalent in the human race. So if you think about that window, that's a real hot spot in development. So why is it? Is it that the world is just horrible to teenagers and young adults and they, you know, are really being provoked by our environment? No, it's the fact that you need your frontal lobe and prefrontal cortex connected to these social parts of your brain in order to manifest these diseases. Because they're, when a prefrontal or a frontal cortex isn't 100% typical of normals, and genetically somebody has a proclivity to schizophrenia or depression, once it comes online, that's when they're going to start to show those symptoms. And that's why it's a developmental event. Many of these are developmental, which means we need to really think about this window as one that's quite vulnerable to being, expressing mental illness, and have our antennae up that a moody teenager may be more than a moody teenager. Parents need to be aware that if the person is withdrawing, losing weight, looking disheveled, it may be more than just them having a bad week. And to begin to probe and try to stay close to your teenagers to understand, you know, what are they going through? And again, we will talk about this. COVID is certainly doing, you know, a lot to distress people, to isolate people, and to make this even more challenging.
You're expressing something that I think is counter then to what we've been taught, at least in my years of training, was that those years, 16 to 26 or 24, I think you said, are hot spots, or because there's pruning going on, and the pruning unmasks, if you will, whatever the genetic vulnerability is. Could you combine that with
it's both.
It's both.
You make
okay.
a good point. It's both yep. things that are happening. So as I said, these different parts of your brain are building synapses. And again, I said it's a use it or lose it. We start off with more synapses and it falls off to adulthood. And you prune off what you don't use.
Right.
And if you've got pruning the wrong parts of your brain that, you know, normally shouldn't have been pruned, that or you're building too many synapses in the wrong pathway,
yeah.
And it's been programmed genetically to be built in that way, that is what we believe in part underlies the, you know, inherited nature of some of these, cognitive, psychiatric conditions. It's both. It's the fact that these developmental events, like the whole process of connecting and also pruning and building, is all the last to go for the brain. It's what's happening in that final last decade of brain development between sort of mid-teens to mid-20s.
Really,
we are talking about the adolescent brain. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the adolescent brain this hour. With us is psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, neurologist Francis Jensen, who is also the author of The Teenage Brain, a neuroscientist survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And I'm thinking, you know, as we're talking about this, I was thinking, it's not going to happen to me. You know, as a teenager, you're like, okay, I understand there's some risks here, but not me, right? I'll be fine.
Well, I think this sort of self-awareness and insight is a piece of function of what this higher part of your brain, the frontal and prefrontal cortex, kind of do in collaboration with your other parts of your brain. So they are going to be less self-aware, maybe, about some of this. And again, because they're, this impulsivity is going somewhat unchecked. But it's important that parents and teachers recognize what they're dealing with, that, you know, you can't just negatively respond constantly. You alienate teenagers when you do that, and then your only line of communication is gone. And if we are sort of, you know, informed adults, we can be helpful to them, especially through difficult times right now. I mean, you know, if we as adults are having trouble with COVID and all of the restrictions it's putting on our lives, just imagine what's going on in the head of your teenager who's never been through any of this, anything like this in their lives, wants social contact, is, you know, driven to social contact, is being told to stay in a very limited sort of environment, and maybe prone to mood swings, as we mentioned, and doesn't have a lot of resources. It feels like the world is closing in. We as adults have to do something to reassure them, you know, about the reality that this too shall pass, et cetera, et cetera. But they don't necessarily have that insight yet, as you point out.
I saw something yesterday on Facebook that I thought was really interesting. It was just a little quote saying, you know, criticizing your child constantly will not make them stop loving you. They'll stop loving themselves, right? And it's so true. It's so true. Sometimes we're so hard on them. We have to remember that. We can't, as you're saying, can't constantly be criticizing these teenagers. But these teenage years are the time that you start forming relationships and creating an identity outside of the family. When the ability to form these kinds of relationships is hampered by all these rules and regulations around a pandemic, this has got a huge emotional impact on teens, right? I mean, Jonathan, what are you seeing in your practice? Is that what you're seeing?
What I'm seeing is essentially reflected in everything that everybody is saying here. And it's the, you know, the normal self-centeredness of adolescence that I think leads a lot of people to feel like, I have adolescent patients who talk to me as if they were the only one experiencing the pandemic. And it's sort of like, you know, they take it really personally, particularly, certain kids, depending on their developmental place, it's especially hard on, for example, kids who graduated from high school this past spring, who were deprived of their, you know, the last chunk of their senior year. But it's even worse now. They're supposed to be going off to college, and now they're experiencing in some form or another the first part of their first year of college. It's a disaster. One of my patients just retreated home from Wheaton College, you know, which is, you know, good school here in Massachusetts. Mom and dad went and packed up her bags yesterday, and now she's going to continue from home because being on the campus, as she has been, but really isolated from everybody but her single roommate, it's really, as Dr. Jensen was saying, sort of incomprehensible, really. I mean, it's just, mm-hmm. it's just terrible.
Yeah. I think there was a question about whether we're having a mental health pandemic in this country. And there was a study that was done by the CDC that surveyed about 5,500 people back in June, just 4 days this past June. This was a self-report survey, so what they asked was, what kind of things are you experiencing? And a total of 41% of the people surveyed mentioned all kinds of psychiatric symptoms, anxiety, depression, PTSD kind of like things, substance abuse also, and increased thoughts of suicide. All of those things were reported to a percentage which is probably about twice what would usually be, or almost twice what would usually be. So the question is that a pandemic? On the one hand, it would be nice if we did have a pandemic of mental health, because concretely that means the world is being flooded with mental health, and everybody's catching mental health. Obviously, we know what the word means, but technically, it's a little bit awkward.
This is the first time in actually, like 38 years this doesn't mean there's been an increase in calls, both from new patients and existing patients, for help. You know, the Twin Towers in New York didn't do it. The recession of 2008 didn't do it. But this is the first time in 38 years I've seen a lot of I supervise a lot of nurse practitioners, and they're seeing the same thing. People are the mental health practitioners themselves are screaming for help because they're not enough hours in the day or enough reserve in their mental tank to help all the people that are asking for help.
Yeah.
So I'm so glad you brought up that CDC observational study. I think there are studies that are going on. There's nothing, you know, outside of that, we're waiting as a field for the publications that will come, you know, to talk about like the actual incidence of suicide, you know, other, you know, mental health, the prevalence of different conditions like depression and anxiety. But what we, you know, the adolescents are at, in a sense, it's a very vulnerable subpopulation. And they, because of like where they are developmentally, and that this may be the first time they've ever experienced depression or anxiety, it's going to feel even, you know, it can feel bigger to them. And it can also be not something that the adults around them are expecting. So one of the things we worry about with adolescents who are undergoing highly stressful situations is their tendency to turn to negative behaviors like substance abuse, and they're doing it less potentially without the risk, the risk assessment adults would, and believing that a way to quell their anxiety is to just get high every day or something. And using that actually as an example of, you know, cannabis use in the teenage brain, there's all kinds of different things you have to think about, not only of the anxiety that they are experiencing, their lower threshold for it, but how they manage it. And the fact is that substance abuse turns out to be part and parcel of the, of this picture. And so teenagers are more susceptible to becoming addicted than adults because, remember I said synaptic plasticity helps you learn? Well, sadly, your addiction circuits are really just learning circuits. So they can actually hardwire, like kids can hardwire memories better, they can hardwire an addiction better. And that's why you see people getting, we all know this, that an addiction sets in teenage years, it's much harder unless you address it. to undo it than if it had set in as an adult. It's just a stronger addiction. So we worry about that. They need to be informed of this vulnerability that they have. We also worry about the effects of the drugs on this construction project that's going on in their brain at that point in time. Every part of the brain that is evolving and developing is susceptible to external influences, good and bad. And when I said plasticity, I mean it. It could be good or bad. They can learn a lot more if you give them more things to learn, but they can also be very negatively affected by chronic stress or by substances. It turns out that substances hit the teenage brain harder. And two good examples are alcohol and cannabis. It turns out that repeated chronic daily cannabis use actually affects the way your brain is being constructed during those formative years of the end of teenage years into adulthood. And there have been studies to show that permanently there's lowered IQ as a result if it's chronic daily substance cannabis use. Now, you know, that goes against what people go, oh, it's harmless, it's fine, it's legalized. Maybe for adults, but the story isn't really out completely, the real science yet. But for teenagers, the science is absolutely showing it impairs learning and memory, and it impairs synaptic development in this window, and the result is lower capacity as an adult later in life. So there are special things we need to tell teenagers about the kinds of coping mechanisms that they turn to, the different vulnerability that they have compared to adults. And this needs to be out there as part of an information package, if you will, to teenagers. They are very smart. Let's respect the fact that they are learning machines. And they just don't have these facts yet. Let's, you know, give them these facts and help them develop the right, you know, decision-making processes in this very stressful time that we're all experiencing. And to also acknowledge and validate the stress they're feeling and not to say, oh, you're just going off the handle. This is ridiculous. Right. No, it's not. It's real.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk to Peter, who's giving us a call from Provincetown. Good morning, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I was wondering, everybody's online more, and especially adolescents and teens. Has there been any research about how that affects brain development and synaptic development? And also, you know, sort of a follow-up, what do you think the effect is? Somebody mentioned Facebook before. What do you think the effect is of Facebook and other social media platforms during the pandemic, and how teens are coping with the pandemic?
Good question. Thank you, Peter. Who wants to tackle that?
I'll take a quick shot at it, and then I'll pass it over to my two colleagues who are, you know, treating patients in this window. So I think it's like everything, there's positives and negatives, right? If this pandemic had happened, well, it did happen over 100 years ago, but I think our teenagers were more resigned to a more restricted lifestyle than ours. But if this had happened in a time without, you know, the connectivity that we can manage over the internet, we would all be in a very different place. I think there's a lot of really great, amazing things about where, you know, being able to use the internet and be connected to people despite being socially distanced. So I think it's a wonderful, platform for teenagers to connect with each other and kind of surrogate, you know, social relationships. And of course, the learning that can happen. I think teenagers are going to do much better, for instance, with online learning than, say, their primary school kids, because they know this platform so well, and they're such great learners, and they have the attention spans to stay looking at a two-dimensional screen for hours on end. But the bad side is something we've been talking about for a very long time, this digital distraction of the brain. You know, how much can you learn if you've got 10 different things plugged into your head and you're not, you know, you're trying to learn a Shakespeare or read, you know, or do calculus or something. So that's a big problem. The other is, of course, the negative and out of context triggers that can happen through Instagram that will cause great stress, or cyberbullying that will, because I've just told you how heightened the sensitivity of the teenage emotional brain is, it can hit them much harder. You know, an Instagram account or a nasty comment on Facebook, an adult would just potentially feel bad about it, but brush it off. It is not the same for a teenager. It's taken with much greater, gravity than would be an adult, and that causes a great deal of stress And that's why you have to sort of stay connected to your teenager and sort of figure out what they're experiencing online. I'm going to hand this over to my two colleagues.
Who wants to add to that?
Yeah, well, I would just echo that. The internet is here to stay, and Facebook is here to stay. It's not going to go anywhere. We want to emphasize, obviously, the positive. And the connectivity is the positive, because you can empathize with one another over the connection, even though it's not face-to-face. And that's what's critical. The whole impact of the pandemic, I think, is to induce a sense of demoralization and grief. So there's a sense that we've just lost our bearing. We've lost our purpose or direction, or who we are has been shaken. And that, I think, is the path toward various symptoms that we see, the depression, anxiety, substance abuse, suicide thoughts. So if the internet or the Facebook helps with remedying the demoralization, then it's a positive force and a positive tool. Again, this is something that's going to be studied and maybe determined down the line, if that's indeed the case. But at least it's a way of connecting without being just alone. There was a piece on NPR earlier today about kids talking about the impact of COVID. One of the kids said, it's really troubling because all I do is I'm sitting in my house and it's just me and my brain. That's what he's experiencing. And it's troublesome to be just alone with your brain. Because we are social animals. So it's a challenge. Definitely parents can't sign off their responsibilities in involving themselves into the their child's internet connections.
Jonathan, I'm wondering.
I was going to ask you, Jonathan. Was some research that was discussed actually on Dr. Jensen's home station of HYY, I think on Fresh Air just yesterday or the day before. Very interesting research, and I don't remember the details, but the bottom line was that there's a lot of evidence that gossip, rumors, disinformation spread much more rapidly, much more pervasively than what we might call legitimate, bona fide, factual information. And I'm not quite sure, well, I'm sure I don't understand why that's true, but to the extent that it is true, it really is very worrisome, and especially for the adolescent population, because this just accelerates, if it's true, accelerates the rate to which adolescents are going to get into trouble, reinforcing each other's mischievous behaviors.
Well, I think it's true because there's a financial basis for it. The companies construct their algorithms to enhance that, because the more clicks they get, the more advertisers they're exposing eyes to mean more money. So gossip and outrageous things are going to collect clicks, if you will. It spreads like COVID does. It just explodes exponentially, as opposed to one person telling another. Information over the back fence is no longer used. It doesn't need to be when you can have exponential communication expand. I think that's one of the things that maybe the government, I think, will get around to looking at.
Let's say 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the adolescent brain and the coronavirus pandemic with psychiatrists Jonathan Schwartz and Mark Whaley and neurologist Frances Jensen. She's also the author of The Teenage Brain, a neuroscientist survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jonathan, you mentioned a patient who's coming home from college. You know, she was feeling isolated with that one roommate. And we're seeing a lot of young adults in the 20-somethings and even 30-somethings moving back home, kind of, you know, turning back to that teen experience, if you will. Not a surprise, given the pressures around a pandemic. And Dr. Jensen, you have written about this. It's a coping skill, right? It's just kind of returning to familiarity. Is it sort of our same thing like when we go for the comfort foods?
Well, I think it's probably a combination of that, but also just the trauma of being on a campus. You're surrounded by your peers, and yet you must keep 6 feet of distance. You're doing your studying in your room on the computer. Maybe you have one or two courses where you do appear in the classroom, but you're not sitting in a cafeteria meeting. I mean, this is when you're meeting all these new people and you're forming these friendships. And I think for a lot of us see that the friendships that you form during your first year of college really, really make or break your experience as a college student. And yet here it's it's almost like having food waved in front of your face, but you're not allowed to eat it. And day after day, week after week, I think it's very difficult, even for people who are pretty well glued together to begin with.
Oh, anybody want to add anything to that?
Well, I think this is why bubbles have you know, started to appear as like a bit of a solution, is that if you can kind of create a bubble, you can actually have some level of, you know, at least in-person contact, even if it's not, even if it's 6 feet, it's still, you're like in the same room. You're not over a screen. And I think that we're going to see, I know a lot of college campuses are sort of rethinking what on earth is going to happen next semester. And I know, for instance, at Penn, they didn't have the kids come in this semester, but next semester they're trying to set up a really rigorous testing, you know, kind of testing every couple of, you know, every couple of times a week, even, to be tested with a saliva test or some other fast-acting test to sort of maintain a population that is known to be negative. And then the next step is how do you keep them negative when they're sitting, say, in the middle, like all colleges or in cities where they can leave, they're adults, they can go off and go to a bar and get, you know, catch COVID. So, you know, how to actually work with the students. Colleges are facing this right now. They're dealing with teenagers too. Let's remember, when you go to college, your brain is not mature. And even when you graduate from college, your brain is still not mature. So colleges are functioning with the same, all the same ingredients that we're dealing with and we're talking about today that parents are dealing with at home. It's just in a much larger scale. So I think this concept of bubbles is going to be something that will get us all through. I know everybody's trying to create their own little bubbles, and I think that's going to be very helpful, but also creative ways to use the internet. And I think there's a lot of amazing innovation that's starting to.
Did we lose her? Well, I was just going to say, let's bring in Gwen then. Gwen is calling from Provincetown. Hi, Gwen.
Hi. Oh, darn it. I hope to ask a question to your guest.
That's okay. You can ask.
I'm the mother of a 17-year-old, and I work with two people in their early 20s. And your guest had mentioned this idea of packaging and teaching young adults this information about brain development, their brain development. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if there were any programs that she was aware of that people could look to see people who are already doing that.
Okay. All right. We're working on getting Dr. Jensen back. Jensen's going to call her back.
Can you hear the radio
ahead
now?
Yep. Anybody have any thoughts while we're getting Dr. Jensen back on the line for Gwen? Okay. Oh, you're back. Okay. Did you hear the question?
I apologize. So quickly, no worries. Packaging, yes. So they're high, they're very fast learners. And we know that we can, if, you know, you position the information correctly and you also make it really relevant to them. So one of the things I've learned about passing this information along to teenagers is you basically, look, our teenagers are highly overstimulated compared to us. You know, their life is one of overstimulation thanks to all of our, you know, digital frequencies that we are feeding our lives. And I always say, if you're trying to make a point to a teenager, make it kind of like a TED Talk. It's got to be colorful. It's got to be relevant. It's got to be snappy. It's got to be to the point. And each point you make has to have like a eureka, oh, I get it now kind of sensation that you're giving them. And so I would say use examples from your, you know, local lives. Everybody has these examples of things that haven't worked out or have worked out, people in this, in your town or in your school or even on the news. Use relevant examples that bring it down home. Like, this is what happens when, you know, that drinking driving, you know, episode, it resulted in this tragedy. Let's talk about this. Why do you think it happened? Bring it home to your teenager. Spend time with them. Figure out how to make it relevant to them. So when we're giving them this information package, it can't just be a rote list sent from the adults, you know, the adults. It has to be something that's interactive, that you ask for their opinion. Respect their opinion, do it in a respectful way, but teach them, you know, you have the frontal lobe. So it is your time for your frontal lobe assist. You can tell them, you know, like, we know that if this, you do this, this is a very likely consequence. And you can predict right now the kinds of things that are going to happen, right? We can predict that people are going to misuse the internet and potentially some bad things will happen. So I'm just talking about the bad things now. It's all the good things. But what are you going to help protect them against? Think about that. What could they come across on the internet that would be not very good for them? What kind of substances might they be have a tendency to maybe think about experimenting with? Talk about what we know about the consequences of that use in this window. Also, we can predict that they may be experiencing anxiety or even depression for the first time in their life. Talk about it. Say, okay, so, you know, everybody is anxious, but, you know, if you feel that this is getting in the way of your daily life, these are the things that we need to talk about, and I need to learn more. And then we need to be seen by a professional to help you work through these things. So you have to put your frontal lobe on and kind of think about how are you going to package this information, what is just blatantly obvious to you about what's happening in this situation that isn't obvious to them, and then give them that roadmap. And explain why their brain has its strengths and weaknesses, and also make them feel good about their brains. They are have an ability to learn more than they will ever have again. So this is their secret weapon, if you will.
And you're inducing practice with them, and that's what helps. You can still have training, even though you might not have the myelin, as it will be. You can still train, and practice is key to training.
Thanks, Gwen, for the phone call. Appreciate that. Hope that was helpful. What about, you know, we sleep? Let's talk about the importance of sleep, because teenagers, you know, we're talking that little kids need a lot of sleep. Teenagers actually need a lot of sleep too. And when you after listening to everything we're talking about here today and everything that's happening, it's no wonder they need so much sleep, right? So, talk about the importance of sleep.
Okay, so sleep we know consolidates memory, so you need to sleep. Adolescents need more sleep, 9+ hours than adults, but everybody needs more sleep than we're getting. And also, adolescents' sleep clock is set a little differently, if you've noticed. They don't want to go to sleep until midnight. And it turns out that there's a biological reason for that, that melatonin, which we induces us to fall asleep in adults, is released in your brain in the middle of the evening, 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and then you're ready to go to sleep about an hour or so later. In the teenage brain, and this is the case of in all mammals, actually, it is released at closer to midnight. So they're not even ready to go to sleep, you know, from a chemical standpoint, their brain, until later. And on top of that, they're charging themselves with all this blue light, you know, texts and, you know, movies and digital distraction, making it more difficult than ever to go to sleep. And blue light does suppress melatonin. So that's going to make it harder for them to fall asleep. Now, having said that, when do we normally wake up a poor adolescent who's only gone to sleep at midnight? At like 6 a.m. usually, to get on a school bus, which we aren't maybe doing so much anymore. And so I always say that, you know, that's like asking an adult to wake up at 3 a.m., you know, and get to work immediately on an SAT or something. Mm-hmm. So again, our work schedule of the day being starting around 6:30 or 7 in the morning is not actually friendly to the biology of the teenage brain. And one of the potential slight silver linings of COVID is that they're working from home. Maybe they can actually get that last hour of sleep before they, you know, roll into the living room or their study to start their 8:30 class online. And this has been an issue that precedes COVID. Obviously, many schools are starting to look at later start times or building in like meditation early in the morning, so the brain is still sort of revving up or doing sports, that it's just not at its best. And we've shown, not we, but the field has shown that these night owl teenagers, actually, when you take a look and see how they do on tests, they do get much better grades for the same material, like in the middle of the day and early afternoon, than they do at 8 or 9 in the morning. So there's, you know, to bring out the best in them, it's probably later in the morning and in the day. But again, this is a big problem with COVID, because you've got this teenager in the house. You're trying to navigate through the homeschooling and when they're supposed to go to bed. And again, giving them this information, you know, at least some of it will stick. Like, you need to try to go to bed earlier. This is the reason why. And also, building in a more structured day is really important right now, because, you know, we as adults are suffering like this terrible feeling of like this amorphous plan to the day. It just sort of goes on and on, and the week goes on and on. And like, where are the old landmarks that we used to know? It's really important that you build those in for your teenager somehow, like mealtime, exercise. That's another thing that's really important to mention here. Exercise has been known, like sleep, to facilitate learning. And actually, you need to exercise for a period of time every day to really boost some of the chemistry in your brain that supports learning. So again, getting them out, making them get outside, making them, exercise is another piece of the structure, I think, that builds in healthy experience during this challenging time.
Yeah. The other thing you pointed out in your book, which I thought was important, is that most of the myelination, the actual chemical work, takes place during sleep. So if the teenagers are shorting themselves on sleep, they're actually shorting themselves on brain development. They're going against a better, healthy brain development or a slower brain development, perhaps, by shorting themselves on sleep.
Yeah. We have just about a minute left. Who wants the final word?
I just want to say that what Dr. Jensen said about structure and creating structure in the day is important for people of every age, and something I emphasize a lot with my patients.
All right. Go ahead, Dr. Jensen.
Yeah. I would say the last thing I would say here is that if anybody's taken anything away from hopefully the new knowledge that is only recently in the last decade and a half available to us, share it with your teenagers and explain to them that if they mind their brain now, it will mind them later.
Yeah, very good advice. All right. Psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, and Francine Jensen, professor of neurology and chairman of the neurology at Perelman School of Medicine, University of Pennsylvania, author of The Teenage Brain, a neuroscientist's survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults. We'll have more at our website, capeandislands.org. Thank you all for being here this morning. Fascinating conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.